Hello, and welcome to the Mayo Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. The numbers we're going to be discussing in this episode are the top 300 trade paperbacks, hardcovers, collected editions, other big items, as sold through retailer, sold through Diamond to retailers for December 2015. We've been looking at these numbers decade or so now, and you know, it's one of those things. Again, the publishers at the top on the trade side kind of rotate around a little, but DC had the most units and dollars for the top 300 trades, 28.06% by units, 31.29% by dollars. Marvel really not far behind with 24.58% of the units, so only, 2.5-3 points behind, and 26.75% of the dollars, so a little bit more of a gap there. But then kind of right on their heels was Image Comics with 20.87% of the units and 21.19% of the dollars.
Mm-hmm.
Those, of course, are followed up by the other two premier publishers. This time, Dark Horse was in fourth place with 5.83% of the units, 4.53% of the dollars. IDW rounding out the five premier publishers with 4.18% of the units, 4.72% of the dollars. So the front half of previews is accounting for 83.52% of the units and 88.47% of the dollars on the top 300. So very lopsided towards the front of the book. Of course, most of these other publishers are, frankly, just publishing a lot less. So it takes them longer to build up a library of collected editions and such.
Yeah. I've also noticed that the average price this month for Image is a little bit higher than I'm used to seeing. And that probably corresponds to the number of units at the cover price of $49.99 for the number one item this month, Brian K. Vaughan's The Private Eye.
Yeah. And let's talk about that, because that was one that they had talked about never printing at all.
Mm-hmm.
Which I was really, unhappy with, depressed by, or whatever, because that's one of the few digital books I've read. Drew was really lobbying for that for a while, and finally by the fourth issue, it's like, yeah, okay, fine, we'll do it. I loved it. It is brilliant. I'm very glad they've done it as a hardcover. I shelled out the $49.99 for that, having read the whole thing for free online.
Mm-hmm.
But man, I love their business model. I think they're doing digital comics the right way. They're taking a very kind of old school approach of it's just print comics digitally, whereas, say, Thrillbent, which is one of the other main digital first comics places, is really playing a lot more around with the format that the digital screen provides.
Mm-hmm.
You can do things on kind of a click and a swipe or whatever, kind of like Infinite Comics over at Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
While that's very cool, I find it very exhausting to read. I've had my right arm rebuilt a few times when I was a kid, and just having to swipe for every damn dialogue balloon just gets tiring.
Yeah, when I read digital, I tend to just read, when you touch the screen, the page changes. I definitely understand that, you know, one of the biggest reasons that we've had expansion in the digital is the new different ways to interact with the content and the new different ways that they can do storytelling. But I agree with you, like hundreds of taps just to read one issue, it's not my idea of a good time.
Yeah. What's interesting is I know a guy who loves Comixology. He's a very much a hardcore Superman fan, kind of a casual comic book reader in general. But the Comixology guided view.
Mm-hmm.
Makes it a lot easier for him to read that, because he was always getting lost with, okay, what panel do I read next? What word balloon next?
Mm-hmm.
And in some books, that, frankly, I get lost, and I've got a ton of experience reading comics. So somebody, a little bit more of a casual fan or whatever, I can see that confusion.
Yeah.
But man, Image brokering a deal with PanelSyndicate.com to print The Private Eye hardcover here. 7,844 units. I think that's great, again, for something that was available digitally, and if you wanted to get it for free, you had that option legitimately.
Yeah. And also knowing that they probably sold quite a few more in other channels like Amazon and things like that. I'm sure they did quite well for themselves.
Well, and this is the kind of thing that I expect them to do well with at conventions.
Absolutely.
Because for a lot of people, they may go to San Diego or C2E2 or HeroesCon or wherever, see some of these guys at the convention, and not realize this material is even out there.
That's true.
You know, being able to have a hardcover of what to many readers would be new material is just awesome and good for those guys. Now, as part of the deal for this, PanelSyndicate.com, my understanding is they've got an exclusive Walking Dead story that Kirkman's writing for them that's going to go up on their website.
Yeah, that's my understanding as well.
So hopefully that gets the PanelSyndicate.com, you know, website a lot more traffic and whatnot, because it's a destination you go for if you want Private Eye, if you want Barrier, and I forget what their other book was, Universe or something like that, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you wanted one of those three things, there's no reason to go there. So again, that's one of the challenges with kind of a web hosted thing, is just getting the traffic to the website.
Yeah, and I think that they are hoping that as the more content comes online there, because I think, you know, in one of their emails in the back end of one of the digital issues, they talked about how the idea had kind of just come to them for their own work, but then as they kind of established as a platform, they would be able to add more creators and things like that. And obviously, in a digital world, name recognition is kind of what really got them on the map in terms of their creators. But hopefully, if they can build enough, you know, of an audience that knows this site exists, they'd be able to break some new artists and things like that. Because I think one of the things I've noticed, especially now that Image is changing the way they solicit things and making creators have two or three issues in the can before they even allow them to solicit, is it's going to be very difficult for someone without name recognition and without a built-in audience that they either built at the big two or built with other work is going to be able to get your shot at Image. I think it's actually a lot harder now to be a no name and start at Image now.
And on the one hand, I think that's almost by design, going back to Kirkman's manifesto from 5-6 years ago now. I mean, it's been a while, where he was really trying to get like the Brian K. Vaughns and the established guys over to Image.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a good move. And I think for those people, the new people, requiring them to have a couple issues in the can is just a smart move. Mm-hmm. Does it make it harder? Absolutely. But look at the number of books at Image over the decades that started strong, but they didn't have that second issue ready to go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we finally got it for non-player after 5-6 years, but it may be another year or so before we get that third issue.
Yeah.
It's impossible to build an audience or story momentum at that rate.
And I think the absolute reality is, in today's marketplace, with the number of titles that are being flooded out each week, especially just between the big two, if you do not have a consistent product coming out, you're quickly forgotten and moved on from.
Well, and that's one of the big advantages that Image offers creators that I really don't know that I've heard anyone, myself included, talk about before. And that's, again, Image always has stuff coming out. How many times have you followed a smaller publisher's work in the back of previews, and then 1 month, they just don't have anything in previews? And they're like, well, is the publisher still around?
Yeah, that's very common. I mean, some of these publishers only have maybe 2-3 series that they're working on at a time. Obviously, they'd love to do more, but they have certain, you know, cash restrictions. And it's just an issue of, if their creators don't get the product in, they can't have anything to sell.
Well, and if you're a really small press that's essentially your book and you're doing everything, you go for a 5-week schedule and you're not going to have something out. You're not even missing a month, technically, but it just doesn't fall that time. You know, again, you're small enough that it's easy for people to otherwise lose sight of you, and that question comes up.
Absolutely.
And again, there was a period where publishers were coming and going left, right, and center. And fortunately, that doesn't seem to happen as much, but it's definitely one of the advantages that I think Image brings. And I'm glad that they are trying to get creators to stockpile a couple of issues just so they can go out of the gate successfully.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got a number of other things here on the list. It's interesting that it wasn't until, what, rank 8 that we get anything from Marvel?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've got Harley Quinn, Volume 2 trade paperback at rank 2 with 5,409. Avatar Last Airbender Volume 11, that seems to be doing really well for them. That's part 2 of the Smoke and Shadow storyline. That trade paperback from Dark Horse did 5,315 units. $9.99 Batman vs. Superman trade paperback did 4,540 units. What was in that one? That was just a collection of various times the two have fought. All right, that's cool. But then we've got Saga Volume 5, reorder activity of that. By this point, we're at 4,404 units. And then the only other thing over 4,000 is We Can Never Go Home, the collection from Black Mask Comics.
Mm-hmm.
So we quickly get into, I want to say lackluster sales here, but it's, you know, a copy or two maybe per store, depending how many you think are out there.
Yeah, it definitely drops off pretty quickly. One thing I will note is that, you know, we've talked, especially for you and and Drew and the other guys, about how badly DC has been handling themselves and just a lot of the missteps they make. One of the rare success stories for them has been the Harley Quinn, and it's, you know, especially done well in the single issues. But you can see here in with the second ranked item this month and also the seventh ranked item this month, it actually does also well in trade. So I think that's just a strong performer overall. And that's one I wanted to highlight, was that I think that they do have a success story here. And I would never have thought that an ongoing Harley Quinn series would have been this successful, both either on the single issue sides or the trade sides.
Oh, I agree with you on all of that. Definitely it's worth highlighting, again, that second trade paperback, that third hardcover and such. It is one of their success stories, no question about it. Over on the comics list, it tends to be one of their higher selling books, mm-hmm. doing well enough that the Harley's Little Black Book bi-monthly series is coming out in addition. Mm-hmm. And that's right on the heels of the recently concluded Harley and Power Girl series.
Yep.
But man, if you had asked me before that title started how I thought it would do, I would have put it probably at about half the sales, a third the sales it wound up doing.
Yeah, it is really interesting when you stop and think a minute. You know, half of the series that they launched recently in the new DCU initiative, you know, things like Martian Manhunter, the Omega Men, things like that. Like, some of them you obviously knew weren't going to do well, but I don't know that if beforehand I would have thought that Harley Quinn would have done any better either. You know what I mean? I almost would have lumped them all together in these secondary or tertiary characters that, you know, are good for a six-issue miniseries, but I never would have thought that this would have been the breakout one.
I wouldn't have thought it would have been the breakout, but I would have been willing to go with an ongoing series for Harley versus, you know, Martian Manhunter. I would have gone with a miniseries.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is her previous series, while it wasn't burning up the charts, it lasted 3 years.
That's true.
And it's a Batman-related character. That's in its favor. It's a widely known character. And it is the breakout character from the Batman animated series that Bruce Timm and Paul Dini did back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of the few really new being a relative term, of course, additions to the Batman cast of characters.
Mm-hmm.
And really the most notable member of his rogues gallery or whatever to be added in recent years, or decades, really, at this point. It feels like years, but it's been many, many of them because how long ago it's been since that groundbreaking TV show.
Uh-huh.
So I would have been willing to give it a chance. I certainly, like I said, would not have expected it to do as well as it did. But really solid art, great writing, fun character, and enough, not done in one, but enough payoff per issue, mm-hmm. that it's certainly worth reading. And I'm sure that in a collected volume that these are really great reads as well.
Oh, for sure.
One of the other ones we've got as reorder activity that's kind of a timely aspect is down at rank 14. We've got Jessica Jones Volume 1 Alias trade paperback. That is collecting the first, how many issues? First 9 issues of the Alias series that the new Jessica Jones Netflix series is kind of based on.
Mm-hmm.
So it makes sense that did well. We've got a few of the other volumes scattered around the list. Let me see if I can find them real quick. There they are.
34.
Yeah, 34, 57, and 80. They go in order of Volume 1, Volume 4, Volume 2, and Volume 3. This, again, is kind of that V formation we tend to see, where the earliest and the most recent ones tend to sell the best. And then they work their way down so you hit somewhere in, not necessarily dead center, but in the middle of the run.
Mm-hmm.
But really, 2,766 units that they got of reorder activity for that first volume, that's over a third of the total reported sales for that.
Yeah, I think that it's definitely had a lot of press in terms of, you know, the Netflix series in general have been pretty successful, especially the Marvel ones. I know there's only been two, but the just kind of the general aesthetic that they've had behind those have been really positively reviewed. And they, I think, to be honest with you, I think a lot of people that review these things were surprised at how good they were with how and how serious the shows are compared to some people view the Marvel movies as, you know, they're definitely made for the mass audience. Whereas I think the Netflix Daredevil and the Jessica Jones, they're definitely made for a little bit of an older crowd for sure.
Oh, absolutely. There's no two ways about that, just with the level of violence and gore in them.
And they're just dark shows.
Oh, very dark shows, but also very sophisticated shows.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And I would say that they constitute roughly 12-hour movies that are like a televised book or a novel.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's serious story plots going on, character growth, and stuff like that. That's a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the fact that it's getting some renewed interest in this older material, I think, is awesome.
Excellent.
Hopefully we'll see some more of that when some of the other ones start up. I think the next Netflix thing is second season of Daredevil.
Yeah. It is interesting when you look at item number 11, mm-hmm. and then item number 15, how the Star Wars Volume 1 for the mainline series, solid reorder activity over 3,000 for a total of 27,193. And then when you do the one that's basically the adaptation or prequel to the actual movie that's recently released, much lower sales, decent amount of reorder activity. It's just interesting to see there's some very, looks like very specific buy-in from the public for certain series versus other ones within, inside the Star Wars universe.
Well, I think anything that harkens back to the time frame of the original Luke and Leia trilogy seems to be what a lot of people are gravitating towards.
Mm-hmm.
Just the nostalgia factor. We know those characters. It was.
Whereas the other one is the new characters, and okay, that makes sense.
Well, actually, the other one is taking place almost like the night of and the day after the third movie of the Luke and Leia trilogy.
Okay.
So it is setting up the scene. It's like the first step on the journey to Force Awakens.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it's like, I mean, I need to reread that and go watch the movie again, but I really didn't see a connection.
Mm-hmm.
So I think people, I certainly had different expectations going into that. I think by the time the trade was offered, you know, enough people had read and reviewed the series that may have impacted how the trade sold.
Yeah. That is interesting though.
But I think they're doing really strong stuff just in general with Star Wars. I mean, also at rank 8, we've got the Darth Vader first volume reorder. Again, another 38,029 units, bringing that to 16,622.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, they're already racking up just between that volume of Darth Vader, that volume of Star Wars, and that volume of the Journey to Force Awakens. And that's 53,616 units of Star Wars just there.
Just in the direct market, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's other Star Wars stuff further down the list, I think.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, as they kind of flush out this universe that they're building, you know, that now that they've wiped the slate clean in terms of the Dark Horse continuity, it will be interesting to see if they are interested in going against their old policy that Marvel had of basically printing to order and maybe a little bit extra, and then if things went out of print, they went out of print, and it sucks to be you if you wanted it. It'll be interesting to see if they're so interested in keeping that cash flow coming in from Star Wars that they're willing to overprint. Because I know that for Marvel hardbacks and, you know, omnibus, there was a strict policy of not overprinting. But for something like Star Wars, where there's so much potential, maybe they'll change that.
I think it would make sense to change that for Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is such a powerful franchise in entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas your average run-of-the-mill Marvel book, not so much.
Yeah.
You know, or really your average run-of-the-mill any other property than Star Wars, be it movies, TVs, games, you know, whatever, comics, etc.
Yeah. And when you talk about kind of like entertainment empires like that, any sort of funnel that you can funnel people into that then they have tons of options to part them with their money, you know, you want to have many different types of points, almost like a spider web, if you can catch as many flies as possible into the web.
Absolutely. You know, you do it with the video games, the cartoons, the action figures, the t-shirts, the you name it. They've got merchandising stuff for Star Wars. You know, which I'm all for. I'm getting some of the stuff too. I'm a big fan.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a safe bet that unless something really tanks, and frankly, you'd know that just from the monthly sales, mm-hmm. that by the time you're setting that print run for the trade or the hardcover, you're probably going to do better to order heavy, pay a little bit of storage fees. It's going to sell over time.
Mm-hmm.
As to how much you print, price breaks, you know, factor in that kind of a deal. Yeah. And how much of a gambler you are.
Yeah, that's true.
And how much cash you have to do the printing at the time.
Yeah. And they might also actually, you know, I know there's not quite the, like, I know that there are equivalent services to Loot Crate for trades, but I don't think they have as much reach. They also might take into account some of their, if they can work deals for initial printings that are huge, where they may be able to do much bigger printings, you know, to get the cost down quite a bit if they know they already have, you know, 100,000 banked so that they can sell to a service like that too.
Comics Bento is the main one I know about, and one of the listeners has posted on the forum a number of times, which I appreciate, both what's in there and has tied it back to this list as to about how much it does, mm-hmm. using that to kind of guesstimate the range or circulation. And I think he puts it at a couple of thousand. If I recall correctly, I'd have to double check that thread.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly we've seen some instances where, you know, if a comic gets, you know, included in one of these crates, mm-hmm. the sales just go through the roof.
Yeah, I mean, speaking more specifically, I mean, the Orphan Black issue that's probably in the top 10 for the year is almost exclusively because it was in one of those boxes, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that was obvious when I got that first issue.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, that may have been the one that got me to start getting Loot Crate.
Yeah, and subsequent, the second issue fall was like 95% or something.
At least 80. It was, it was horribly large.
Yeah.
But that comes down to, is the goal to sell a comic or to make money or to sell the series?
Yeah.
And there's right and wrong answers in all of those regards, depending what your business model and such is.
Mm-hmm.
What I thought was a really interesting move, and I looked for it and didn't see it on this list, it might have been on a previous month's, was Chrononauts was in one of the boxes I got.
Mm.
And not just one of the issues, it was the full trade.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Matter of fact, I wound up with two of them because I'm trying to think if it was the Z-Box, the Geek Fuel... I'm getting them all confused these days is the problem. But it was one of them where we got kind of a bonus box
mm-hmm.
that wound up being one of the boxes we'd gotten before. I think it was the time box from one of them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, well, okay, I've got another one of these. But I don't recall seeing Chrononauts shoot up on the sales chart or whatever on the trades. So, and it was a big enough box circulation-wise, I believe, I could be wrong on that I would have expected it to have been a visible kind of a sales thing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also possible that some of that stuff happened in a manner that Diamond wasn't involved, therefore it doesn't show up on these numbers at all. Or it's remotely possible, although frankly it seems unlikely, that Diamond may have considered it strictly promotional sales or whatever and didn't include it.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
Because one of the things I noticed going through the year-end numbers is I did not have sales figures for Invincible number 118, but that was a 25-cent issue. And therefore they declared that as a promotional thing and therefore didn't include it in the list. Yet, again, they'll do that Rocket Raccoon, they'll do that Orphan Black, that to me are very clearly promotional buys.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a little confused as to what criteria they use for some of that. For my money, it really skews the numbers to include things that are bulk purchases.
Yeah, no, I agree.
But, you know, that's just what I'm thinking.
I wonder almost, though, I mean, I guess from your perspective, is it better to at least know that those numbers are out there than to not know about them at all?
I'd like to know about them, certainly.
Yeah.
The more information I have, the happier I am. I'm just a data junkie in that respect. But they are different numbers.
Yeah.
They are a different measure.
And they're, I mean, if you really think about it, it's almost a different audience.
It's a completely different audience. I'm picking up some of these mystery boxes or whatever for, you know, they sound cool or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly didn't pick any of them up because I thought I'd get a full trade paperback of Chrononauts.
Yeah.
I'm happy to have gotten it, don't get me wrong. But if I go into, be it a comic book store, and therefore it shows up on the direct market, or I go to Amazon or Barnes & Noble or whatever, and I go pick up that trade, I'm specifically buying that trade.
Mm-hmm.
To me, there's a much different meaning of those same sales figures, which is something I think some people misunderstand when I say that, you know, those promotional sales aren't the same thing. Because their counter is usually, well, it equates to the same dollars. And, you know, these bulk purchases, I assume they're getting at a discount. If not, they should be. So you could even argue it's not the same level of dollars. But regardless of that, it's a completely different intent behind the purchase.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, if I were to look at these numbers and I knew, and it's not the case because Private Eye, again, that's something people are specifically buying. But suppose an item at that level had been something that we knew was old material and in one of these crates. And it's like, well, you know, sure, it topped the list, but nobody bought it specifically.
Mm-hmm.
It was included with something else they were buying. I would interpret those sales very differently.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
But, you know, we'll, again, I want to see all that information. I was annoyed not to know from the monthly numbers how that issue of Invincible did. But, you know, that's the joy of the year-end stuff. I can usually deduce roughly how it did from that.
Yeah, hopefully, I mean, you'll at least be able to try and get a ballpark, right?
Yeah. This was one of those years, and we'll talk about the year-end numbers next week, mm-hmm. But this was one of those years where they did not include an index ranking.
Mm-hmm.
So I had to kind of guess, well, the item below it did this, therefore. And let me tell you, you know, as much time as it takes me to crunch the monthly numbers, the year-end numbers, oh, geez, that is just brutal because the format changes a little every year. It's been a year since I've done it. And all the data cleaning I don't necessarily get done every month comes back to haunt me.
It all lands on one day, right?
Well, because I'm looking at it, it's like, how come it doesn't know how much Howard the Duck number one sold? I know it was, we thought it was 2007 volume in my monthly one. Crap, I missed that.
Oh, gotcha.
And that's where the constant reuse of titles just kills me.
Oh, for sure.
One of the things I think is worth discussing a little bit here, since we're talking about is the goal, you know, to sell an issue or just to make money in general and, you know, however you do it is okay kind of a deal. If we look at the breaks in the sales here, where after we're out of the top dozen, we're below 3,000. When we're at rank 32, we've crossed below 2,000 units. We hit below 1,000 units down at what, rank 117 and such. There are a lot of these items that by the time we get to the bottom of the list with the top 300, that 300th item doing just below 400 units, it's one of those things where, yes, I've said before, it makes sense for them to continue to publish these things regardless of it not doing particularly well. Granted, the two items below 400, both reorder, so different thing. But a lot of stores just aren't ordering a lot of these things.
Mm-hmm.
And I trust the retailers to be aware of what will and won't sell in their stores. And I'm certainly not suggesting they should order more for the sake of ordering more. They can't sell it. They shouldn't buy it. They should not incur the risk.
Yeah.
It's woefully unfair that they tend to have to, but it is surprising to me how many of these items are selling something that is just a you know, under 1,000 units or something.
Mm-hmm.
Surprisingly small numbers. And again, this is nationwide into all of the comic stores, not even what they're selling to readers. So you've got to imagine a high percentage of these are still sitting on store shelves.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
It's tying up a lot of cash that could be used to more profitable uses from the stores, whatever.
Yeah. Well, I think this is another partial example. I think obviously for things near the top, it's different because, you know, the old adage goes, if it's popular in the comic stores, it's often popular everywhere else. But I'll give you an example. Down at 271, the Mobile Suit Gundam originals, it's on its 12th volume. This is a really nice hardback of the Gundam series that they've been putting out. And through the direct market, they're only selling 443. But I've known from reading interviews with the publisher that this series is one of their best sellers. And it, on Amazon, it's one of the most popular mangas sold. So it's just like, I think that, well, when you see really low numbers here, sometimes you have to be careful because it just, this outlet might not be at all where they move the maximum amount of their material.
Absolutely. And Gundam is one of those things. That's something that would appeal to the anime crowd and such like that. It's got a very big audience for Gundam.
Yeah.
Just not here.
Yeah. And in the, and a counterexample to that is number 18 in the list, Attack on Titan, which moves 2,485. Up into the top 20, which is actually relatively good for a manga in the direct market for the United States. And that actually, I'm not sure if you're familiar with how popular One Piece is in Japan, but Attack on Titan is, I think this, just this past year, passed One Piece in terms of number of the latest volume, either volume 16 or 17, sold over 1.8 million. So there, you know, this is a probably top two manga sold in Japan right now. And obviously it sells hundreds of thousands of copies through Amazon and other retailers. And you can see the disparate difference.
How much did that sell in Japan again?
1.8 million copies for the latest volume.
1.8
million. Yeah.
Million.
Yeah.
The entire top 300 here. Unless I've got a filter on that I'm not wrecking. No, I've got them all. Is a third of a million.
Yeah, and that's just for that volume, right? And this is volume 17. So, and I think One Piece is up to volume 60s or 70. So you can see how the cumulative effect for things like that. And obviously, manga is very different. And in Japan, it's different because they're almost, that's their primary form of literature. So it's different there in that context. But also just the sense of there are tons of these volumes in each of these series, and each of them sells that high number.
Well, and that's something I thought has always been a missed opportunity for American and other publishers not in Japan and such. Imagine if DC were to take their either their Batman books or maybe their Justice League books or whatever, a family of titles, package them up as manga.
Mm-hmm.
And just, boom, here's the stuff. It gets released over in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Sure, you've got to translate the material. You've maybe got to flip the art around, whatever. And some of it may sell better than others or whatever. But when you've got, in some cases, books and characters that have been going on for decades, you could repurpose that into a solid story stream or whatever over there for a fairly long haul and do pretty well. Because, like you said, they just it's such a major form of literature and entertainment over there.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the other thing that I know we did have, especially when Borders was around, manga was much more popular. And there's been some pickup the last year or two as the market has reestablished itself. The other thing I really am impressed by manga is that you get so much bang for your buck. You know, it's almost 200 pages a book and they're at what, $9 to $10? I mean, that's almost a better price per page than some of the image first trades, you know, because oftentimes you're getting a $14.99 or a $20 128 page trade, and almost no manga volume is shorter than 200 pages.
No, it's a great format. Mm-hmm. And it's got the advantages of size that trades have and the frequency in many cases and story momentum of monthly issues.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the best of both worlds. But in many cases, these are things that are serialized, you know, in these phone book size deals that are just, you know, 12 to 20 page. I'm not sure how long the installments are, but short installments every week.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then they collect the full thing into that full trade.
Yeah.
Or the manga or whatever.
Yeah.
It's a very different kind of a business model, but also one that in that society is just crazy effective.
Yeah. And with the huge numbers they have, it's quite sustainable, you know, especially at the top. I mean, just like in any form of entertainment, it's difficult to become a popular, consistent manga. But once you're there, the financial rewards for the creators are extreme.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it comes also from having a commuter culture.
Mm-hmm.
They kept the price of the manga to read as you're commuting cheap.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
These aren't collectibles. These are just throwaway entertainment.
Exactly. Exactly.
And that's frankly where I think comics here in the States kind of went wrong. Mm-hmm. You know, if you could pick up a 50-cent comic book, it's like, yeah, okay, it's fun, it's great. And maybe I like it, maybe I don't. Not a big deal. Now you're paying $4 or $5 for that. That's a very different return on investment equation there.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that comics sometimes forgets is that if you make the barriers to entry low and you make it cheap enough, people don't think about spending the money. But when you make it $3.99 for 20 pages filled with ads, people think. And when they think, you give them a time. And the other issue is that there's hundreds of different types of entertainment available to today's individuals, you know, TV, games, everything on their smartphone. There's just a lot competing with people's time. And realistically, what you're really competing for is people's time and dollar. And there's just more choices and it's harder. And I think that comics does, you know, a lot of them shooting themselves in the foot. The industry has done themselves harm, but they don't realize that it's a lot harder to always be in the person's mind when they have all these things pulling at them.
Well, and once you get in their mind, wouldn't it be nice to make a second sale?
Yes.
How many of the Marvel comics published in 2015 have enough issues to get to a second volume of a trade?
Very good question, and I would hate to see the answer.
The only two I can think of, and I'm sure there are others, but the two that pop to mind are the 10-issue run of S.H.I.E.L.D., the Marvel Universe Avengers Assemble Season 2, which I think is getting up to about issue 13, 14 or some such. Beyond that, and again, 2015 is a bit of a trick question in that regard, because everything stopped, did Secret Wars for 5 issues, and started again. But it, again, it breaks the momentum. It's hard to get that mind share and to really get somebody in the habit of buying multiple trades.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, I mean, I'm very much a monthly comic reader. So I've always, and part of it is I've been reading for forever and a day. So
before
by the time
popular, yeah.
Yeah. But by the time the trades came out, it's like, I've got all these issues. I don't need them.
Yeah, for sure.
It just feels like it would be hard to get into the habit of every 6 to 9 months or whatever, oh, maybe there's another story to go read. Flip side, you get a full story, and I really respect that. You know, that's something that I think they need to do a better job on the monthly side.
Yeah, for me, it's definitely, I get a sense of, is this a title I'm really committed to? Because I get 5-6 issues to really see, do I like where the creators are going? Do I think this series is able to have enough story or have enough oomph, basically, to go, you know, 20, 30 issues in today's comic world? Mm-hmm. And that would be as long as we get. But yeah, so I definitely like the reading a first trade of a series really gives me a sense of, this may not be for me, or this is, ooh, this is great. Let's have a lot more of this.
Absolutely. It gives you a chance to get a full sense of what they're trying to do versus almost a teaser in a first issue.
Yeah. And oftentimes the first issue, you know, depending if they don't have extra pages, it's very hard to tell. There's only a few things that happen, and then you have to make a decision whether to continue the series or not.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if it's a slow burn, it may take the full first story arc to really figure out what's going on, get some of the characters to even interact with each other.
Yeah, for sure.
So I'm of the mindset that additional pages on first issues are good, but having a first issue that really grabs a reader makes sense. While it might be fun to have things start as a trade paperback and then do monthly, you know, kind of the idea of like an extra length pilot episode of a TV show before it goes serial. I wouldn't want to have to make that investment of a $10, $15, $20 trade sight unseen for the material.
Yeah, I mean, Brian Hibbs has talked a lot about that, how like a lot of the problems with the OGN market is that standalone OGNs that are outside of like recognizable character OGNs like a Batman or a Spider-Man is that you're asking people to take a $15 to $20 chance, whereas the periodical market, that's easier to do with $2.99, $3.99. Although as they continue to raise prices and lower content, it's becoming harder and harder even then, especially as they have more books coming out every week.
Yeah. Well, I think Marvel averaged 2 or 3 first issues a week over the course of 2015. Not to say they had that many every week, but again, we hit that bubble as everything was ending and then starting again for Secret Wars and then ending again and starting again after Secret Wars.
Yeah.
You just got a ton of them.
Yeah, where some weeks it was nothing but number ones.
Yeah, and you lose readers. Every first issue is a potential jumping off point if it's something that's just a revoluming versus an actual first issue.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, I'm at the point where I get confused as to, wait, was this story I really liked? Which Iron Man series was that in? Or which of the plethora of X books or, well, Inhuman books? They've got so many of those.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I've asked this a few times, but I want an actual answer from you this time. Which do you think, if you were in charge of a comic book company, is the goal? Is it to sell particular issues or particular volumes? Is it to get people hooked on reading a particular title? Is it just to make cash however you can?
Oh, I mean, I think the reality, John, is that for speaking from a personal perspective, I would hope that you would, by investing in creators and stories, you'd be able to accomplish those other goals. But I think, and that's what I would hope would be the direction you were headed, especially at places like Image, where hopefully the focus is on the creators. But I think the stark reality at Marvel and DC, as they are small divisions of a huge conglomerate, is that they literally look at the revenue numbers and say, this needs to be higher next quarter. What can we do to make this higher next quarter? And they see units, and they see spreadsheets, and they see numbers, and that's what they see. I really honestly think that's what it comes down to.
Well, I totally believe that and agree with that, and that's how they should operate to a degree. Mm-hmm. I mean, you got to look at the metrics. If a title is not performing, get rid of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are a couple of books. I mean, Telos, I think the 6th issue is the last one. It's selling under 10,000 units. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure when we see it on this trade list, it's going to be not so high on it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like that would have recouped the loss. So there's a certain dollars and cents. You've got to make money. But the really, it's a question of what do they focus on? What should they focus on? And at times, it feels like they're doing the variant covers as a cash grab. They're doing the number ones as a cash grab. They're packaging things up as hardcovers and trades and collect, you know, Uber Deluxe collected editions or whatever as a cash grab. And they're focusing on the packaging of the material versus the substance of the material. And that they're often going for the buy this right now, and then tomorrow I'll tell you what to buy right now, and the day after I'll tell you what to buy right now, versus trying to get that sustainable revenue stream.
Oh, and I completely agree with you. I think that's the obviously what's happening. The reason I think is that the reality is for them is that to take the time to actually do some experimentation and see if you can change things requires such a risk, at least in their minds, that they might not have their job by the time the results from the experiment comes out. So they're not willing to risk it because they may be fired because the numbers didn't go up or the numbers went down too much, and that they're not willing to risk their job or their position to try the different things that maybe the market needs. And it's almost like a tragedy of the commons thing. Everyone needs to do different things, but the person that will get punished hardest is the person that tries it first. So no one does. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. It's a great way to phrase it. And when you were saying about that, I was trying to think through over all the years I've been watching the industry, both while podcasting and before, how many times can I think of where there's something that I would actually consider a true experiment of how can we sell more books? What if we try this?
Mm-hmm.
And the only thing that really is coming to mind, and there may have been others, but was when Bob Wayne over at DC did some experimenting with overshipping, free overshipping of books.
Mm-hmm.
And he was very tight-lipped about the results of that, with his response usually being along the lines of, you know, we took the risk, we reap the rewards, we learn the lessons from it. Not going to teach everyone for free.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And while he may have been a little flip sometimes in how he may have said that or phrased that, he was 1,000% correct.
Mm-hmm.
He took some risks. He made some gambles. Whether they paid off or not, they learned some lessons. And should they keep that to themselves? It'd be nice if they shared. But yeah, they have every right to keep it to themselves.
And I think there's also a stark reality that I think some people will acknowledge, but some people won't, is that the way the market is fragmented, one company that's not Marvel and DC moving together has very little chance to actually change things, because the way that Diamond has set things up in terms of discount rate and the way that they run their business really limits the choices and the things that the retailers can change. And everything kind of, it all flows downstream or upstream, whichever way you want to talk about it. It restricts how publishers set out their product. It restricts how they market. It restricts how they do things. You know, part of why Image is changing how they demand things from creators is because Diamond has a specific way of doing things, and that's the only people they can offer comics to the direct market through. You know what I mean? So there's all these bottlenecks to where even if you had some innovation, it would be very difficult to get it to propagate through the system because there's so many different players that don't necessarily have their interests aligned.
Absolutely. At this point, DC, Marvel, and Diamond are the ones who really are big enough to do some experimentation. Mm-hmm. And Diamond's a distributor, not a publisher.
Yeah.
I would say the one publisher I can think of in the past few decades that I thought had the potential of fundamentally changing the marketplace, but it did not have deep enough pockets to do this, was I'm just now blanking on the name. It was the company that did Free Mind, Future Comics.
Mm-hmm.
It was Bob Layton, a couple other guys and stuff. They did some really solid comics. What they did that was unique is they didn't go through Diamond.
Mm-hmm.
They sold direct to comic stores. There was a risk to that, a cost to that, a serious effort to that. But what really wound up essentially killing them was when they finally capitulated and went through Diamond.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they weren't getting paid on time, a few other things here. It's just, mm-hmm. had they been able to stay the course and prove that it worked, and it was working for them,
mm-hmm.
For at least 6-8 months, I think they could have been the voice that started to break the exclusive deals with Diamond and the publishers.
Yeah, and it's true. It's all... It is a general question of is there just been so much momentum in the way things are right now that there is no way to make big changes. And the only way big changes will occur is if there's some sort of bankruptcies at some of the probably top five publishers. Do you know what I mean? Like the only way to actually get some drastic changes were to be Diamond to come under some sort of financial pressure, or one of the five or maybe two of the top five publishers to have serious financial issues. I don't know.
I think it would be something that is certainly a financial issue, but I think aside from somebody having financial problems and forcing a change, which would be detrimental, mm-hmm. it would take a serious cash influx to make some changes.
Yeah, that too. Mm-hmm.
Again, if somebody could prove that there was another viable methodology to it and have the time, the money to make that happen, and then be convincing some of these publishers that as their periods of exclusivity, you know, come for renewal, maybe you don't go exclusive with Diamond.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you try this other route. Would that necessarily succeed? No, there's no guarantees, of course. It could be a complete and utter flop. But it would take something like that to get to where the exclusivity agreements with Diamond are fewer and further between, that there actually could be another distributor. If that even is the best thing for the industry, which it may or may not be.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, because I mean, the thing we've talked about on this podcast often is that there's not one pain point. There's not one area of failure. There's almost at every level of from where a comic starts to where a comic gets into a reader's hands, there are areas where the comics industry is almost working against itself. And so oftentimes we talked about, well, this person could change this or this company could do this differently. And they probably could, but they might not necessarily reap the benefits of it. And someone else might take the benefits of it in higher percentage or a cheaper cover price. And then that company that took that risk may not see any sort of positive return.
Or at worst, feel punished for having done it.
Exactly. I mean, that's one of the biggest things that Brian Hibbs laments all the time is that both the DC, Marvel, and even some place like IDW, they need to publish less comics. But the problem is the second one of those companies publish less, the others will flood the space because it's all about rack space. Half of the reason why Marvel keeps other publishers down is by taking up rack space.
Well, and while I think that's a very legitimate argument and one I agree with, another perspective on it is if you publish fewer books, that does not mean you make more on the books you do publish.
Oh, no, I completely agree. But I think that's a part of that is a consequence of the other things they're doing that aren't contributing to making the less books they have, more successful. You know what I mean?
Like absolutely.
The other things.
But it becomes a 1-2 punch.
Oh, absolutely.
You cut your publishing line substantially. Other people fill the void because, ooh, there's more space on a physical space on the physical racks.
Mm-hmm.
They get some more sales that way. You've lost some sales because you've, you know, consolidated your line. You're focusing whatever. Suddenly, it looks like your percentage of the market share and the whatnot of the breakdown of the top 300 just plummets. Oh, yeah. Well, now things look bad. It looks bleak. And it becomes almost not a self-perpetuating cycle or whatever, but it sure doesn't seem like fun.
Yeah. Well, and the executive who made that decision would probably lose his job at some point.
Depending who it is, what company he's at, and if he is the one who would fire himself.
Yeah. Well, at a company like Marvel, it's Disney who would make that decision, right? Because Marvel is just a small department of Disney.
Yeah. But again, there's no incentive for anyone at Marvel or DC to substantially cut their line.
Oh, absolutely. I completely agree with it. I think, you know, I hear from retailers all the time, it's like there's too many of these books. I sell 1-2 copies a week. It's just not even worth me ordering them. You know, but then there's all these shenanigans that the companies do to try to get them to order them. And we've talked about, you know, in order to get this variant or to get a good deal on this, you have to order 125% of your orders on Invincible Iron Man or something other crazy like that. You know, just all these things that just drive the retailers crazy.
But I think it would behoove like a Marvel and DC. And again, they're playing at one level
mm-hmm.
that other publishers are not. And this tactic might work for some of the middle tier, the IDW Image, not so much Image, it's just unique in and of itself, but some of the other publishers. I think if Marvel and DC were to go with a more data-driven approach and try to target different demographics, and I think they are doing some of this, whether it's data-driven or not, you know, let's have a Muslim Ms. Marvel or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Let's have an African-American Captain America. Let's try to make some characters that are more relatable to a broader percentage and spectrum of Americans and whatnot. And again, get these books to where they're not all clustered and overlapping and hitting that same market necessarily, but get it to where, yeah, they may not be selling great, but this book would be selling to 10,000 different people than this other book.
Mm-hmm.
Now, granted, maybe both are selling 12,000 because there's a little overlap or whatever, but now you've brought different people into the comic shop.
That's true.
I mean, to me, that diversifies risk substantially, and it's just a better way to make money. You know, trying to get more dollars out of fewer people is a losing proposition mm-hmm. versus trying to get fewer dollars out of more people. But again, that takes a certain amount of risk, a certain amount of you know, putting your job on the line for some of these people. And frankly, I don't blame them for not doing it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot to be said for having a steady paycheck at these companies. And if you were to gamble and say, you know, I think we should do this, this, and that entire, you know, set of titles just flops and they're all under you, the responsible thing for your boss at that company, your publisher, to do is to get somebody else there.
Mm-hmm.
But it's how do you balance that long-term growth without sacrificing kind of the short-term needs for cash flow and staying profitable.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, again, I look at all of these items that are just not selling particularly brilliantly. And when the median sales, kind of the midpoint on the list here, is around 815 units, I got to think, you know, things could do a little better.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, obviously the companies know this, but there has to be a point at which it's not worth printing these trades.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, at this point, we're, you know, further in the list, we're seeing a lot more reorder activity and whatnot. Mm-hmm. And that makes sense. But, you know, with 143 of the items on the list being reorder, that makes sense. Longer shelf life, et cetera. I got no problem with that. But even if we filter that out and just look at the remaining, 160 item, actually a little less, because I've got a few things below the top 300 here. The average at that point, 1,245 across 157 items, so that put the median at rank 79. Let me see if I can find that real quick. That puts the median at 978 units, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just a quick one. I may have counted wrong. Which, ironically, is DMZ Deluxe Edition Book 5 hardcover from Brian Wood.
Mm-hmm.
And it's ironic because that's one of the books historically, in some past years, so much of its activity flew under the radar.
Yeah, as trades and stuff.
Yeah, it would pop up just surprisingly strong on the year-end numbers, whereas it just, you know, often didn't show up on the list at all during the monthly ones.
Yeah, it was just chugging along at the right below the surface level, basically.
And to me, that's a huge sign of success.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to sell big numbers, but man, if you sell consistently over time, you're doing something right.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, the people like Robert Kirkman have talked about how that's also why you do as many series as you can do. And it's much easier, obviously, for a writer, but you basically create different islands of intellectual property. And one may take 10 years to blossom and one may hit right out of the gate. You know, Saga obviously does very well for Brian K. Vaughan. And part of that is based on his long career, but something like Why the Last Man or some of his other series that weren't as popular right away have continued to sell extremely well in trade. Part of that's the Vertigo effect, but you know what I mean? Like he has this residual income coming in, and that's how I think a lot of the creators need to think long-term. It's very difficult to break into the comics industry and to be successful and to make a living. And one of the ways to do that is to have a variety of income streams coming in. Sometimes you're going to have to plant seeds that aren't going to pay off for a long time.
Well, it comes down to passive income at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Once you've got that collected edition out there and it's available in the backlist through Diamond, it's available on Comixology, on Amazon, stuff like that, mm-hmm. kind of that long tail kicks in potentially.
Absolutely. And the other huge benefit, benefit of digital is that with almost no effort and work, you put the material that you already put all that effort into, you put it online, and potentially it never goes away, you know, except for some small hosting fee that depending on if you have to pay it or the seller pays it, you know, every day hosting is getting cheaper and the cost of having data by the megabit or gigabit is going down. Do you know what I mean?
So. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. With digital comics, the long tail really comes into reality.
Mm-hmm.
And if you haven't read the book, I really recommend it. It's a great read. But the idea is you don't need to be one of those items that's at that top of the bestseller list. Hell, you can be beneath the radar on some of this as long as you're doing slow and steady stuff. It adds up over time versus a lot of these things pop up big and then just vanish.
Yeah, exactly.
And with physical books, there's the printing cost, the shipping cost, the storage costs, and from a retailer perspective, the space cost.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, Brian Hibbs, again, I think he has added so much value to the industry just with his articles, his books, and all of his thoughts on comic book retailing. He's been very generous with his opinions, his knowledge, and his experience there. And he's talked often about how, you know, if a book is sitting on his store shelf for X amount of time, you know, he's not making money on it.
Well, and in fact, with the amount of rent he has to pay in San Francisco, he has to be very careful about how long something sits because that real estate that he's literally paying for is very expensive.
And I am trying to think if I read this in an article. It would not surprise me if Brian Hibbs has actually calculated what one, you know, typical trade paperback width of shelf space costs him.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But he's a forward thinker. He's a smart guy in that respect. He knows the cost of having that sit on his shelf and not selling. And I think he had also said when he first went over to a point of sale system that he was realizing just how much certain books he thought was actually selling weren't.
Yeah, that he thought that they would sell at least once a month. And he found books that would sell maybe once or twice a year. And he's like, I should not have this in my store. It's not necessarily a bad book, but it's just my clientele, the people that come into my store, they do not purchase it enough, especially enough for with my rent that I have to be able to turn it over.
Absolutely. And I don't know. I've never set foot in his store. At some point, I would love to. I think it'd be an interesting experience just because of all of his stuff that I've read.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how big it is, how crowded it feels, how fully – I mean, I know it's fully stocked. Don't get me wrong. But if it feels like an overwhelming amount of material he's got or if it's just appropriate for the size location.
Because
I've been in some stores that it's, wow, this is a great selection. There's room to walk around, nice light. It feels comfortable. I've been in others that, man, it seems like there was not any physical space to put another book in that store.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and the interesting thing from his perspective, if you should check out his website, savagecritics.com. In the last week or two, he posted his top sales, I think top 100 or so for on the periodical as well as the collected edition side. And the other interesting thing is it's been 1 year since he bought that other store. And so his main store is almost, I think he said like 70% trades and hardcovers and things like that in terms of sales. But when he bought this other store, he bought it right before it was about to go out of business.
Uh-huh, I recall
and
that.
It was a completely different clientele, and it was almost the exact opposite. It was like 70% single issues. And so he has some good analysis there about how things have changed as he's kind of gotten to run that store, how he got it up to speed, how it still is vastly the majority of his sales are still single issues, and the percentage composition. So like at his main store, he's a huge indie seller. Like he sells a ton of image and a ton of you know, Fantagraphics and things like that. Whereas at the new store that he recently bought, that 70% periodicals, it's Marvel and DC. You know, it's a superhero store. So it's just very interesting to see, you know, they're only separated by, maybe 5-10 miles. I don't know what the distance is, but they're just completely different clientele.
That had to be a very interesting experience for him. Mm-hmm. Because I, again, having read his stuff for many, many years, decades, I would imagine, he's not somebody I think has a lot to learn as a retailer.
Yeah.
In terms of he's been doing this, 20, 25 years successfully, learned a lot of things, had a lot of very good thoughts as to what should change in the industry. One or two of which may have actually happened. But again, it's one of those, the people who would need to make the change didn't have the incentive, therefore it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's good for him and other retailers to have that sort of experience where running one store, you think your reality is one way, and it is. But again, a store in this case, like you said, 5-10 miles away could be radically different.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, part of it he talks about, I think it's relatively close to either a community college or some sort of school. So it's just going to have a different type of clientele anyways. But I know when he first bought that store, he had a couple posts on his Savage Critics site about, you know, basically going in and trying to organize things, and down in the basement or in the storage area, you know, the previous owner just had long box after long box of extra copies of, like, you know, Marvel's Infinity, you know, remember that series, and just, you know, how the previous owner had ordered a certain way and how he was trying to transition and what he's going to do with all these long boxes of extra comics that literally had almost no value. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it was interesting.
It's funny because periodically Austin Books here in Austin, Texas has a sale, and they trot out some of that type of material that's just kind of collected. And I swear 1 year, and this is a couple of years back, they had an entire long box of JLA Avengers number 3.
Yeah, it's just like random things.
I mean, a full long box, maybe that and a half or whatever. Now, granted, it's a thicker book, so whatever, but still.
Yeah.
Certain stores are going to overorder on some things. It happens. And I think with the advent of trades, the back issue sales became a very much a niche kind of a collector-centric thing. And I could, again, definitely see how if you're running one store that's heavy on trades, heavy on indie, you think everything Marvel and DC doing may just be ridiculous or whatever. You just don't get it. Whereas then if you're running only that other store and that's all people are buying, you're like, why do people even try doing indie books?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can't tell you how many times over the years I've heard retailers that I talk to at conventions or whatever say that the numbers I've got here and the numbers they're selling are just so out of whack. It's like, you know, like I'm reporting from a different reality.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I am. I'm doing national. You're doing local.
Yeah.
So it's interesting stuff.
Yeah, and it kind of to speaking to that point, he also has a recent article about how he thinks that there in the next 6 to 8 months, there's a real chance for a number of stores to not be able to continue because of the way that DC and Marvel are going, and that some of the stores, 95% of their revenue is from those two companies. And so with how DC has kind of fallen down a little bit and the way that Marvel is handling some of their business and the huge drops that they're having from their number one issues from their new relaunches, he thinks that a lot of these, because, you know, a lot of stores are just such a cash on hand business and they're running a month. And if you have a bad week, it puts you behind the eight ball on a lot of things. And plus you've already ordered ahead. So it's kind of like, it's very difficult to catch up.
I think one of the biggest risks to the industry right now, aside from potentially, you know, unfortunately foolish decisions that could get made at Marvel or DC, would be a collector speculator boom and bust.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're in the boom now. And if it busts, man, we are in trouble.
Yeah.
Because some of these books, I think, could dive into negative numbers. If people getting it for the variant covers and all that stuff just exit in mass.
Yeah, it is definitely an interesting time for sure. I listened to it, you know, when you talk to the other guys about the single issue stuff, and you can just tell they're like, I don't understand how Marvel thinks this is a good idea.
Well, this is what I love about doing the podcast these days, is I've got you here on the trades. You bring one perspective, very informed about all of this stuff, which I love. Sam, when we talk about the comic stuff, is coming from he reads, you know, certain stuff, not other stuff, whatever, a bit more of a limited scope there, which is fun. But he's also coming at it from a retailer perspective of not comics.
Yeah, absolutely.
So there's certain parts of the comic industry that I think just boggle his mind, and rightfully so.
Yeah, you could tell when Sam is like, how are any of these people in business? There's a part you could tell with the tone of his voice sometimes. He's like, I don't know how all of these people aren't bankrupt by now.
Well, it'd be like going to a retail outlet in a foreign country that just has a totally different mindset.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
You're like, but, you know, how does this work?
Yeah.
And then Drew, again, when we talk about the reviews, we talk about some of this stuff, is coming at it from a very pro-Image kind of a standpoint, which makes sense. He loves their books. They do great books. Very much wanting to support some of the smaller publishers and some stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And again, just the different vantage points I really enjoy, because again, I've got my own vantage point.
Mm-hmm.
I'm all in on Marvel and DC. I'm very heavy on the monthly comic side, have been forever and a day. I've got a very long-term perspective on this. And that's not to say any of us have the right perspective or a wrong perspective or anything. The truth of the reality of a lot of this stuff is either somewhere in the middle or somewhere a little off, depending on what we're seeing, what we're noticing.
Mm-hmm.
And man, with 300 data points on the comic side, another 300 on the trade side every month, I know it's easy for me to miss stuff. Just because, again, I get the numbers, I crunch the numbers, I do the article all in kind of a rapid succession during a weekend or whatever. But I look at how much data I would feel I would need to digest and interpret were I a retailer like Brian Hibbs or these other people out there who are on a day-to-day basis having to make some really tough decisions. Gee, do I get this Star Trek trade? Maybe that next movie will get some interest in it. Or do I support the manga a little bit more? What about this thing from Marvel or DC? What about this lower run DC title? Do I even bother getting it in the store?
Mm-hmm.
And man, it's a very dynamic market. And, you know, I look at these numbers and it's not that they're bad or anything. These are, you know, not horrible, you know, in terms of non-typical numbers or something. But it's also like you're playing for very high stakes with very small denomination chips. Because again, some of these things are selling in the hundreds of units. And this was one of those months where, you know, we only had a few items over 5,000 units. And that's not horribly uncommon. But if comics were really capturing the interest of the American populace as one would think they ought to based on how movies are doing, how TV shows are doing, etc., I would think there'd be more stuff going on in these numbers in terms of higher numbers and just less risk. And frankly, the last thing I read from Hibbs was very, not the sky is falling, but kind of cautioning, you know, hey, keep an eye on this. This doesn't look so good.
Mm-hmm.
And I've got to, you know, agree with the assessment, if not necessarily all the reasons. Again, I don't recall his exact rationales, but man, I look at the standard sales trend. It's not so healthy.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, and I would go nuts if I were a retailer.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I hear all the time about people wanting to start comic stores, and I say, wow, that seems pretty crazy to me right now.
It does. I mean, again, you look at this past year with Secret Wars, Convergence, a number of titles that started and stopped and whatnot from Marvel and DC, plus the ever-going rotation of stuff at Image, which is just their business model and such. It's such a ever-changing market.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you look at a couple of publishers, again, your point about people trying to fill up the shelf space. Titan Comics went from, you know, hey, let's do Doctor Who to doing, it seems like, every Doctor under the sun.
Yeah, I've wondered how they're going to be able to, like, I totally understand wanting to work through all the, you know, 10, 11, 12 doctors there are. But I would have thought that they would have staggered it so you don't have any more than two or three doctors at a time. So you're doing, you know, 4 to 6 issue miniseries. And then when one finishes, you can bring up maybe the next doctor, obviously going backwards from 12 to 1. But they've seemed to just want to bring them all out relatively. I mean, they've got 4 or 5, I think, right, coming out now. Like, you know what I mean? Like, they have 12, 11, 10, 9, and getting ready for the 8th doctor. And, you know.
I would have staggered it to where no more than 1 a week, and probably 1 a week.
Oh, yeah. No, I just meant in terms of, like, the actual specific doctors. I agree with you in terms of the titles coming out per week. You know, you see that actually happen with a number of the licensed series. Oftentimes, both Transformers or 3 Transformers comics will come out 1 week, and then you'll have, like, a 4 or 5 week gap. And it's like, couldn't you have planned this out better? Or the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles sometimes don't come out, and then they all come out on the same day. Or, you know, the same kind of thing where, you know, they have this kind of, like, shared world that they're have different books that are kind of weaving in and out of, and then they just kind of dump them on you, and they don't realize the vast majority. I mean, I guess they have to realize this, but I don't know why they don't think it through. The vast majority of comic readers, they go to the comic shop every week, and they have a specific budget. They have a 20 or a 40 or, you know, 40 bucks, and what they see on the wall, they pull until they're out of money. You know what I mean? And so if you have everything, you make it harder on yourself to be able to get people to commit.
Well, my expectation is that they're thinking from the vantage point of, if somebody's coming into the store because they want Doctor Who, do we really want to make him come in every week? What if we just have him come in every third week and they get everything then? Figure, you know, feast or famine kind of a thing is the better way to go. Mm-hmm. I disagree with that. Yeah. I'd rather they get the people in the habit of the Doctor Who fans coming in every week and getting something every week.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or same thing with Star Wars, Star Trek, Transformers, you know, all the other ones you were mentioning and such. You know, spread the load. But I've also got to imagine that there is a cost savings for shipping and printing and such to do them more in all at once versus spread them out.
Yeah, that's true. And speaking of, you know, Doctor Who, this month we have at number 168, 169, the third volumes for the Doctor Who, the 10th Doctor, and Doctor Who, the 11th Doctor. And we're looking at, you know, 700 some copies for each, which is not great. And maybe this sells better in other markets like Amazon, or maybe it sells, you know, better in different markets because the Doctor Who fans are primarily Doctor Who fans and not comic fans. But it's just, that doesn't seem like particularly strong numbers. And yeah, it's the third volume in a series. But, you know, with the rate that they're putting these things out and the number of doctors that they're kind of compounding, you would think they wouldn't do that unless they had a certain amount of demand. You know what I mean? Or maybe they literally are like, well, we're going to burn them out, so we might as well get as much out of it as we can.
Well, the comics are selling an average of around, I'm going to say, a little under 9,500.
Mm-hmm.
And that's across Doctors 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12.
Okay.
So, I mean, it's doing a little under a tenth the sales, which is not a bad ratio.
Okay.
And both the two Volume 3s, the 10th and the 11th Doctors hardcovers here, we've got, one, they're hardcovers, not trades.
Mm-hmm.
And two, they're really not off all that much, maybe a few dozen units, from how the previous volume did.
Okay, that makes sense.
So I think they've got a loyal audience.
In the direct market. It just may be bigger someplace else. So.
I would certainly hope it's bigger. It seems to be a pretty big hit of a TV show.
Oh, yeah. No, I'm just saying in terms of Titan has to pay a licensing fee to BBC, and I'm just wondering, you know, at what point is the break-even point for printing these? I mean, obviously they sell more outside other channels. I'm just saying at a certain point, you know, that's one of the reasons that maybe IDW let the licensing go is because they weren't making enough money to justify keeping the license.
Absolutely. And the question is, how is the license written and worded?
Mm-hmm.
If you've got the license for Doctor Who for say 2 years, 3 years, or whatever it may be. I have no idea what they've got. But you've got Doctor Who. That means you've got each version. So if you're paying one license fee and you're able to leverage that across 6, 7, 8 different comics,
mm-hmm,
a month or whatever, which is how many they had this time, it becomes a bit more profitable.
Yeah, and so I can see also that being an incentive to publish more is if you're paying for Doctor Who and you have 12 doctors, well, we should exploit those 12 properties almost as if they're on their own properties. Yeah.
And again, we've seen this a lot over at Dynamite.
Mm-hmm.
You've got the Bionic Man, do a bunch of them. You've got Green Hornet, do 1,000 of them.
Yes, yes.
And there's a certain strip mining and wearing out the property if you're not careful. But it's also, frankly, something I would like to see Boom take note of with the Power Ranger property. If they've got the license to the Power Rangers, not just the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, but the whole franchise, they've got another 20 teams of characters that they could be doing miniseries, one-shots, or whatever on.
Yeah, that is a good point. I didn't think about it that way, for sure.
I mean, they could be doing Power Rangers Dino Supercharge, which is the series that's about to start up. You know, they could be doing other ones that are, you know, some are more fan favorite than others. But I'm willing to bet they could do decently with those if they do good work.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, again, the strength of these licenses is partially dependent on the strength of the property, partially dependent on the strength of the execution, partially dependent on the strength of the publisher. Again, you look at how Dark Horse did with Star Wars, and you look at how Marvel's doing with Star Wars. Night and day difference. And that is no disrespect to what Dark Horse did. I think they took great care of that property for the, 20 or so years they had it.
Oh, yeah.
No,
I have a few of the Star Wars series in, you know, hardcover. There's especially a few Darth Vader series that I think are just great, outstanding comics, let alone Star Wars comics. And I absolutely love them. And they're the Dark Horse versions for sure.
I've got at least a drawer box or two filled with nothing but Dark Horse Star Wars comics.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure how many I've got of the current Marvel stuff. I'm sure before too long I'll have enough to fill a short box. Because they keep coming out. They're good reads. They're really some of the best stuff Marvel's doing these days.
Yeah, definitely.
So what else caught your eye on the list this time around?
One of the things that caught my eye was the gallery edition for the Sandman series, and it was at $175, so I'm not sure how to gauge whether this was successful or not. It was at rank 174, and it sold 697. I don't particularly see this selling a huge amount of copies outside the direct market, but maybe I'm wrong. You know, when DCBS and in-stock trades are included in Diamond, I would think that this captures a large portion of that market, and it just seems, I don't know, maybe it's the price, maybe this material being so relatively old, you know, I don't know. I it's hard for me to judge. Is $697 good for that since it's so expensive? Is it not? Because it was, you know, Sandman being such a perennial contender for best comic series ever. Do you know what I mean? It's kind of interesting just to see that number.
It was the second most profitable item on the list.
Okay, so then DC probably considers that quite a success.
I would consider that a definite success.
Yeah.
The item that did better than that was, it was Private Eye,
mm-hmm.
Which just sold, you know, in order of magnitude better than it at half the price.
Yeah.
A
third about, yeah.
A third of the price, sorry. So, well, actually almost a quarter. $50 versus $175. Definite price difference there.
Yeah.
But no, normally when something is that high, I would say doing the 700 almost units, that's pretty good.
Yeah. Well, I think that they probably have, a little bit of overorder. And so we obviously won't see the reorder activity, but they'll probably eventually sell through those. It's kind of one of those things where if people have to make a decision to spend that much money to buy it, you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's something at that price point I would be hard-pressed to justify myself.
I mean, I'm sure it's gorgeous, but I mean, and I'm a huge Sandman fan, but that was definitely outside my bracket.
I mean, I spend a ridiculous amount of money on this stuff, but anytime I see an absolute or even as an artist edition, I step back and say, what else am I getting this week? And do I really, or this month in the order? And do I really need to get that?
Yeah, but they are gorgeous. I will say that though.
One of the other higher ticket items on the list, at rank 227, is the Alias Omnibus volume. No, I guess that is the full one. That has the full run of the Alias stuff that, again, Jessica Jones is based on.
Mm-hmm.
And also a What If issue in there. And that did 544 units.
Mm-hmm.
Again, $100 item. I think that's doing pretty well.
Yeah, and it's a reorder, so they've already have about over 3,000. So
exactly.
Yeah, so, you know, I think Marvel has done a decent job of kind of, you know, especially with the Daredevil and the Alias, when they have their show tie-ins, they do try to reprint stuff. They're actually pretty good about that. You know, one thing I was interesting about DC, and you know, maybe shows that they're still having issues with their move across country, is with the new Supergirl TV show, they really didn't bring out a comic, and I would have thought that would have been a no-brainer tie-in.
I agree with that. She's not even being featured in any of the other books, as I recall.
Yeah.
And talk about a missed opportunity there. And then the title they're coming up with, Legends of Tomorrow, to nominally tie in with that series. The only common point is Firestorm.
Yeah, it's interesting to see where they're putting their emphasis, you know, and I think the honest truth is they have a lot of their eggs in the Superman versus Batman movie basket. And if that does not do extremely well, I think there's going to be some major changes made in the company.
What I would do were I over at DC is I would try to get a Supergirl Season 0 digital comic going.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, and likewise, something along those lines for the Legends of Tomorrow.
Mm-hmm.
You know, again, you've got a bunch of characters there. You could just do rotating solo features or what have you.
Yeah, and they've showed, you know, DC has actually shown success in that digital first model, you know, especially when compared to Marvel. So it's not like they don't know how to, you know, have those series and be successful, and they know how to roll those series out. So I am a little surprised that they haven't done anything.
I think they're a thought leader in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
They're very forward-thinking in how they're doing their digital-first comics, between the digital revenue stream, the issue revenue stream, the collected edition revenue stream, etc. I think it's working out for them, and they've also just had some really strong properties.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Injustice Gods Among Us, the Arkham stuff, you know, they've had a few that, not so strong in my opinion, but Batman 66, the Wonder Woman 77. Again, I'm still hoping for a Superman based on the old Black and White TV show. It'd be a lot of fun. But yeah, I think they're doing some great stuff there, and I'd like to see them do more with that and really leverage some of the success they're having on TV.
Mm-hmm.
So if we look at the price points, man, they are just all over the place. With $14.99 barely edging out, $19.99 is the most popular price point. It's 48 issues or 48 items versus 46 items. Next most popular is the $9.99 price point with 31 items. Actually, no, it's $16.99 with 32 items. My mistake. And then the 31 items at $9.99. But I mean, that right there, just those four price points, that's half the list.
Mm-hmm.
And we got everything from $4.99, $5.99, all the way up to the $100 and the $175. So a few high-ticket items this time around. But really, the overwhelming majority of the material is $50 or less.
Mm-hmm.
That's like 96.33%, which is good. I like lower-priced stuff.
Oh, absolutely. And I think especially in the trade world, it's, you know, when you're trying to get people outside of the medium to kind of come in, you want to be as inviting as possible, and price is one of the barriers to entry. And so, you know, comics needs all the people it can get, and if the average price keeps going up, then we're even more trouble.
Well, and I think that's where trades, while they're a bigger investment, there's also a better return on the investment.
Mm-hmm.
And the fact that 75% of the list was $20 or less,
yeah,
that's a good thing.
Yeah, and the other thing is, and this might just be, you know, for me and people like me and you who order, the other nice thing about trades is that, especially through the retailers that we order through, trades are almost always heavily discounted, whereas oftentimes the single issues for the first issue or maybe the first couple issues are heavily discounted, but then they go back to the normal discount. For Marvel and DC, specifically and oftentimes Image, oftentimes all the trades are always heavily discounted. I'm talking 50% or more. So, you know, there's a lot of bang for your buck in terms of what you get for your trades.
Well, and I think that's also why we're seeing some lackluster sales on many of these things, is it doesn't make sense for the average retailer to really have a copy on their shelves if we can go to Amazon or in-stock trades, mm-hmm, and get, you know, a 25, 30, 40% discount or something.
That's true.
You know, and we can get stuff digitally, so there's less of, oh, I missed an issue, so I need to get the trade. This whole market of older material has just, it's shifted fundamentally over the last decade or so. And will continue to do so as digital picks up steam, and by which I mean it's plenty popular. It's not like it's new and breaking in. But there is going to come a point where people just don't feel the need to get your average trade paperback. And I think the focus could shift to more of, I want this coffee table book. I want this thing that looks really nice on my bookcase or something. I want that absolute. I don't care about the average hardcover or trade.
Mm-hmm.
For that, people may just go digital.
That's true.
So it's always fun to watch how the stuff shifts over time. Again, I thought this was it was an okay month. It was not one that just, you know, really knocked my socks off in terms of overall sales and stuff like that. It was well above average, but we've had stronger months. Matter of fact, this is probably the weakest month we've had since January. Or no, actually since March.
That is interesting, considering you know, it being the month, you know, being December, being for gift giving. It is interesting.
Yeah, I think we had some stronger months before that, and hopefully stores had just been slowly stocking up before that.
Yeah, that's true. And to come to think about it, a lot of the companies will release their biggest stuff for the holidays in the month of November so that the stores are properly stocked in, you know, people shopping, obviously, for Christmas gifts in November, as well as holiday gifts, you know, through the month of December. So, you know, having stuff come out and be readily available in November makes more sense.
Well, and if I was a retailer, I would be tempted to try to split some of that stocking up over October, November, at least, if not in December, possibly as far back as September, if I knew stuff was a safe bet. Versus, again, trying to even out that cash flow versus having it all kind of hit at once. The worrisome thing is, again, it was not a strong December on the trades list, and generally, first quarter of the year, not so good.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll be interesting to see how January shapes up.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, and going forward, we're going to start getting more of the Battle World trades and things like that. So it'll be interesting to see how Marvel's big event from last year kind of filters through.
Yeah, both how the like, again, the Battle World, the other Secret Wars collections hit, and then also that first round of trades of when we get the new number ones. Because that really was a turning point, I think, for Marvel in 2015, was when the post-Secret Wars stuff kicked in.
Mm-hmm.
So, should be fun to watch.
Yeah, no, definitely something to look forward to. I definitely will be also looking forward to listening to you and Sam's issues, because I think he's just waiting for things to take a tumble. So it's yeah, I just get the sense that he's like, I can't believe this is continuing to go on.
And I can't fault him for that. There are a couple of things. It's just, really? Again? How has the industry not collapsed from this? Or why are they doing this again? Didn't they learn this time? You know, whatever. It's funny. No, I'm recording with him tomorrow as we record this. It'll go up the Friday after this goes up on a Wednesday. And then again, next week, we're going to have the year-end numbers.
Yep.
For the trades and the comics. So. Yeah.
No, I'm eager to look at those, because it should be interesting to see, you know, how many different things that kind of were below the top 300 but kind of continuously sold, and, you know, to be able to aggregately pop up into the top, you know, not obviously at the top, but, you know, there's things that you wouldn't expect to see that you're going to see. And then obviously just to see some yearly numbers, just to see what the, you know, total quote unquote aggregate revenue is for some of these books, and what's obviously popular, what I read will probably be in the middle, because I tend to read a lot of independent stuff. So it will be definitely interesting to take a look at that stuff.
Oh, absolutely. And again, there was no index value on the list.
Uh-huh.
So it's going to be one of those where I've got the total estimated reported sales, a guess at what the unreported units were to get something where it needed to be on the list.
Mm-hmm.
And then the yearly total of the two combined. So a guesstimate on that.
Sounds good to me.
But man, that's one that's going to be a little, some of those are going to be ballpark figures versus estimates, just because maybe my database didn't find something it should have. It'll be fun.
Yeah, it'll be fun. And I, you know, I hope our listeners understand that this is not an exact science, and these aren't, you know, the hard and fast numbers, because, you know, you always hear about, you know, certain people, creators saying, oh, when I get my royalty statements, they're totally different than these diamond numbers. And you've obviously explained before how, well, you hope the numbers are different because they're also getting foreign sales or other things and things like that. So, you know, our numbers are the glimpse that we have, not necessarily the glimpse that we want.
I would say to that certainly the royalty statements creators are getting include stuff outside the direct market. foreign sales, etc. It's a much bigger picture than we have visibility into. So absolutely. But I also think that they are 1,000% wrong when they say that these numbers are incorrect for what they measure.
That's true. That's true.
I stand behind, say, that estimate of 7,844 for Private Eyes hardcover as what Diamond reported is sold through the direct market.
Yeah.
Now, if it is wrong, I blame Diamond, not my estimates.
Yeah. Well, and I think part of it, to be honest with you, John, is also that creators, what happens is that, you know, creators have egos just like anyone else, and they go online and they look for reviews of their material. And when they're Googling, they'll find someone who looks at the numbers and says, the series is not selling well. It's going to be canceled soon. And as a creator, you're always cognizant of what the minimum is to meet these things. And we know that under 20,000, Marvel likes to cut. Under 15, DC likes to cut. You know, we know these general, after looking at the data for as long as you have, you know that there are thresholds that the big two, and yes, they fluctuate some. And sometimes you get an Omega Men where, you know, which is just weird. And it doesn't.
It should have been canceled.
Yeah, no. And everyone knows that who will take a second to think about it. But you know, either it's a passion project or they want Tom King to be happy because he's the new hottest writer right now or whatnot, you know, or there was enough people were angry online, yada, yada. But you and me know that that's really what the creators get angry about is the public being able to see inside a little bit and to see that this series isn't doing well. And when you've poured yourself into something and want it to succeed and it doesn't, especially in how competitive comics is, you can take a little umbrage to that and people's egos get a little bruised. So that's what that usually is.
Oh, it absolutely. And I totally understand it. And if it's just, hey, you know, you're not seeing the full picture, I agree with that.
Yeah.
Brian Wood, again with DMZ, was really riding me hard at one point. And guess what? He was 100% correct. Mm-hmm. I hadn't seen the full picture because it wasn't showing up in the list I was looking at. Mm-hmm. But I also was correct in reporting the numbers I had as what has been reported and sold that month.
Yeah.
So, again, it's understanding the data, and I'm certainly not trying to do this to make anyone look bad.
Yeah.
If anything, I'm bemoaning and commiserating with them their stuff's not selling as well as it should have, because, damn it, most of this stuff's really damn good.
Yeah, no, and you know, as someone who reads a lot of independent comics, I definitely feel for a lot of these creators because – oftentimes, I think that the stuff that independently is put out is oftentimes quality better than stuff the big two puts out. But the realities of the marketplace dictate that below a certain point, you're not making money and no one works for free, or at least most people don't. So that's the reality of it.
Alas, I do this podcast for free.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But you
silly me.
Yeah, but you do go to your day job so you can pay your mortgage. So
that is true. That is true.
So
anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
I think that does it for this month, and looking forward to next week.
Cool. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening. The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If they differ from your reality, please verify you are in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. The Diamond Order Index only goes 2 decimal places, and therefore there is a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. Some numbers are rounded to the nearest 100 for convenience. This may introduce a further level of inaccuracy. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications there is at least one retailer that may have an excessive amount of empty shelf space with dust it needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 different comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 300 comic books for the month. The list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 100 different graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 100 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, the list of top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 50, 25, or excuse, and items. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time that you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which, as far as we know now, has not been successfully invented in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales, any comic books, graphic novels, and or collected editions that are not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 100 graphic novels and collected editions lists is included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond.
No information about sales or lack of sales of any items sold outside the Diamond Comics distribution channel is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for, and no amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer is here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is void in the ultimate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Ath logic and the English language itself seem to work very differently there.